Ezekiel chapter 9. Does anyone have any comments or questions from last time that they didn't get to ask?
You guys have gone a long way.
Yeah, we're almost through 9, too.
I mean, we did quite well with you guys right here.
Yeah, we were
rabbit
out of you guys.
Where is the rabbit? Oh, he's here.
The rabbit is here.
Hey, Jerry.
Yeah, the rabbit got out of whiplash while you were
Give it to me now.
No, that'll give you license to go on the rabbit. No.
Okay, so we actually read through verse 7 and pretty much talked about that. Were there any questions or comments from that section before we kind of finish up the chapter? Remember, it's about the numbering the people or going and marking the ones that are godly, essentially, or and then God's going to send these, apparently these angels, right, to slay the ones that are not. Well, if not, we can pick it up at verse 8. I'll go ahead and read it, I guess, since it's short, and I'll read it. And then when it's long, I'll make someone else
read
it.
Yeah, sure.
And there's no begats in that section either. I checked before I came.
Right.
So it was, while they were killing them, that is, the people that didn't have the mark, I was left alone, and I fell on my face and cried out and said, "Ah, Lord God, will you destroy all the remnant of Israel and pouring out your fury on Jerusalem?" Then he said to me, "The iniquity of the house of Israel and Judah is exceedingly great, and the land is full of bloodshed and the city full of perversity, for they say, 'The Lord has forsaken the land, and the Lord does not see.' As for me also, my eye will neither spare nor will I have pity, but I will recompense their deeds on their own head." Just then the man clothed with linen who had the inkhorn at his side reported back and said, "I have done as you commanded me." So here we see, you know, the heart of a, you know, what Jesus, the heart that Jesus wants the people of God to have when God is judging, which isn't vindictive and go get them.
Yeah.
It's, you know, he's interceding. And he's not necessarily concerned with, you know, everybody, but he definitely is mentioning the remnant of Israel. He's concerned that that things have gotten so bad that God's maybe going to destroy even the remnant of Israel. So it seems like he might be in a similar thought pattern like Elijah, where he's with the prophets of Baal, and he's thinking there's no one else really left. And of course we know God's response in that was that he still had 7,000 that he had reserved. And so I think, you know, you see the same thing here, even though God doesn't really respond to his question directly. Obviously, we know that God's not going to destroy the entire remnant of Israel.
Well, the fact that he sent the guy with the inkhorn out.
He said what now?
The fact that he sent the guy with the mark.
Yeah, implies there's at least one.
Yeah, happy
a few.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. Right. So I think it's interesting too in this, and I guess we maybe touched on this last time too, is that they're so far gone in their rejection of God that they don't even think God's even paying attention anymore or around, which is interesting because I think there's a lesson there for us too, which is that God is still engaged and interested in what's going on even when it looks like it's gone past a certain point. Because there's a tendency, we can get kind of negative at times, I guess, and say, well, you know, things are just so bad that God would never do this or he'd never do that. You know, he's just completely, he must have checked out by now, it's just so bad. But clearly, you know, if if God, you know, they didn't think God was really engaged in what was going on around there anymore. If they had repented, he would have undoubtedly responded positively. But yeah. He knows that they're not going to at this point. So any observations or thoughts on that little section? Not a lot there to really talk about, huh? It's pretty straightforward. Should we go into chapter 10?
Yeah.
So who wants to read the first two verses of chapter 10?
Two verses? No.
Jerry's going to go for two verses.
That's all right. I'm just joking.
Two verses? I can do two verses. And I looked, and there in the firmament that was above the head of the cherubim, there appeared something like a sapphire stone, having the appearance of the likeness of a throne. Then he spoke to the man clothed with linen, and said, "Go in among the wheels under the cherub, fill your hands with coals of fire from among the cherubim, and scatter them over the city." As he went in, and he went in as I watched.
So here we now are seeing cherubim, which we saw last, remember, back in the early part of Ezekiel chapter 1. And so it's describing now all of a sudden it mentions a likeness of a throne. And so there's over the head of the cherubim is something like the likeness of like sapphire stone, and then there's a throne. And from before what we saw in chapter 1, what is it that he's trying to describe again, do you think? Do you remember? What it was in chapter 1.
The vehicle that they're riding in. God's riding in.
Yeah, it's the vehicle. It's portable throne. Right.
Throne, portable throne.
And so it's this idea of the throne again we're going to see as we get further into this. And so you've got the cherubs that are wheels are under the cherubs,
mm-hmm.
and then the firmament is over the head of the cherubs, and then above that is the throne. So this sapphire stone is kind of like the base of where the throne sits. And I think if you look through other passages like we did when we were in Ezekiel 1. You'll see it's an analogy to the sea of glass in heaven. That God's throne is people stand on a sea of glass.
And that verse is almost exactly the same.
Can you read it?
1:26. And above the firmament over their heads was the likeness of a throne, in appearance like a sapphire stone. On the likeness of the throne was the likeness with the appearance of a man high above it. That's why it's really different.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Unless we get to verse 3 and it tells us.
And so in Revelation 4, there's a throne. In verse 6 it says, "Before the throne there was a sea of glass, like crystal."
Hmm.
And it comes up again in Revelation 15:2.
But then that throne there seems to be a permanent throne. It is a permanent throne, right?
Yeah, it does appear to be that way.
Yeah, because they don't have the wheels and the cherubim are different, aren't they?
They're called Zoa. They're living creatures, and they're described a little bit differently. But So there does seem to be a difference as far as the portability, but then when the throne is mentioned in Daniel 7, I think we looked at that last time too when we were looking at chapter 1, but when the Ancient of Days is seated in their thrones, it mentions his throne was a fiery flame, its wheels a burning fire.
Mm-hmm.
So in Daniel 7, that when the Ancient of Days judges and it's time for the saints to receive the kingdom, that throne had wheels, and so it's more akin maybe to this in a sense. But clearly, the picture here is God's glory is, we're going to see it depart the temple, and so the idea is that he's normally dwelling between the cherubim over the ark, right? There's those cherubims that are two cherubs, and his glory would reside there over the mercy seat, over the, you know, the Ark of the Covenant, and so that's in the Holy of Holies. And this picture here is basically him getting into his VW bug to leave, you know, to vacate.
Kind of, that's blasphemous.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, so it's like, yeah.
So Tony, you're talking about different stones, though, like in Revelation, two different ones, Sardis and whatever, and then the other one, you said, no, at the beginning, chapter one was like jasper or something? No, lapis.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's sapphire.
Right.
So there's all kinds of different stones going on.
Ask our stone expert.
Our stone.
Yeah, they're all different colors.
Yeah. So it's the very same one with different colors.
Well, I don't remember the last time we were talking about what stone, but you look it up and they end up having a color range to them.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
You might have thought it was blue, but then it comes in red and green.
Mm-hmm.
So. Back
then,
that was one of them. Well, I think ruby is going to be red, always.
Yeah.
But
and emerald.
The other one, emerald, can be different shades. And,
green.
Yeah. Mm. So it's pretty confusing.
Yeah.
But then 2,000 years ago, or whatever, 4,000 years ago, I don't know.
Yeah. Right.
Because they can make some colors too.
Right. And then the translations use different English stones for what they think the Hebrew means.
Mm-hmm.
They're not all in agreement about exactly what it is. And so I think the thing to get from it, you know, in settings where there's, where it's referring to the tribes, you know, then I think there's probably pretty clear correlation to the breastplate that has the 12 tribe stones. But in settings like this, it seems like it's trying to describe a translucent, very colorful, you know, glorious looking, clear but solid kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I just kept thinking, well, if in chapter 1 and chapter 9 it's referring to the same scene and situation with a portable throne, that it would be, you know, described the same.
Well, does yours use different names for that stone in your translation?
Right. Well, this was sapphire and the first one was lapis.
In yours?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm going, okay, so why do we switch, you know? And
yeah, good question.
You know, because you're tying them to be the same situation we're talking about, right?
Yeah, it's, I think
unless
it's,
I missed something.
Well,
I
and it could be that material can look different ways at different times, right? Depending on your point of view when you look at it and stuff, so maybe it looks like both, you know?
Maybe one they're looking up and the other one they're looking down. I don't know.
I don't know either. But he says a little bit later, he says it was like what he saw previously.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's in, let's see, where is it? Verse 20, this is the living creature I saw under the God of Israel by the river Chebar, and I knew they were cherubim. So he's at least saying that the cherubim were like he'd seen in chapter 1. Maybe the rest of it isn't identical. Here it doesn't say there's a likeness of a man on the throne, where it does say that in chapter 1.
Right.
But I think this is one of those things that I think we would be doing too much to try to read a lot into the differences, because I think it's still representing the glory of the God of Israel in his portable throne. Because there's so much that is exactly the same, pretty much, plus the function of it. So, so so what's about, why is he scattering fire over the city, do you think? What's that supposed to?
I have an idea, but
yeah?
I don't know.
What's
would it be
no.
to, what? Sometimes it'd be, I would think it'd be a cleansing,
yeah.
Possibly.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I would think.
Finding.
Because usually it would be fire, you know, coals of fire, but I was thinking something more for God's wrath, but then I got, sounds more like a cleansing where he's mm-hmm.
purifying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that
wasn't there, was it Joshua or
Isaiah?
One of them, anyway, Isaiah. They took the coal and touched his lips with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's in Isaiah 6, yeah.
Okay.
So when you study out the fire thing, you get two primary uses. One's purification, like you're saying, cleansing, and then the other, like our God is a consuming fire,
mm-hmm.
right? And the consuming fire has two aspects. One is he consumes sin and purifies. The other aspect is he judges.
Yeah.
So there's the baptism by fire, for example, or Sodom and Gomorrah, God scattered coals of fire on the city, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's places where God does call Jerusalem Sodom and Gomorrah, right? So you can also see the picture there potentially of people making an analogy between Sodom and Gomorrah in this as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the setting, it's definitely a setting of judgment, and maybe in the judging of the idols and the destruction of the temple, he's essentially cleansing the temple too, right? Because that's what he ends up. Eventually, they're going to rebuild a new temple.
You
without
think
the
if he was judging the whole city, he just, you know, instead of coals of fire spread out in different places, like maybe
mm-hmm.
maybe he was cleansing the areas of you know, like in the temple or wherever
mm-hmm.
the problems were existing
mm-hmm.
in the city. I don't know. But then, of course, he leaves the city anyway, right? So I don't know.
Right.
What the deal is.
Right. Yeah. Well, clearly in Isaiah 6, where the Isaiah says he's a man of unclean lips, and then the cherub brings a coal and touches it to
yeah.
his mouth. That's definitely purification, cleansing. Yeah.
I may be misremembering, but like, wasn't there something that like the priests were supposed to do at Sodom? Pretty similar, like they're supposed to take coals from the altar or something. I can't remember, but I may be misremembering it. But I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't think of something
right
off.
That was just.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it is. Yeah, I may be misremembering that. Mm-hmm.
Sounds
familiar.
So it's, we know for sure biblically it's either purification or judgment or both, right? So you can, if you want to think about Sodom and Gomorrah, God raining fire down upon it, or in the book of Revelation, he rains down fire and hail upon the earth in judgment.
Mm-hmm.
You could make that case, and then the other case would be like in Isaiah where it's used to cleanse and purify.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess this would be literal to everyone. it seemed to me as though this wasn't literal here in this particular.
Right. I would tend to agree with you. I think this is a vision that's showing, he's revealing how God sees things in the spiritual realm.
Right.
But there wasn't literal fire that fell upon Jerusalem. Jerusalem was burnt by Nebuchadnezzar, who set fire to it, his
mm-hmm.
troops. But it wasn't like Sodom and Gomorrah, which was literal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that mm-hmm. that would be the case.
And could we look at the six men and the battle axes and everything as not being literal, as being, you know, maybe going out marking people and actually then people dying, but necessarily wasn't, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to get into the looking at things not literally, because
yeah.
I believe we're supposed to
right.
look at it literally.
Yeah, I think there's a possibility that's true. I wouldn't want to get real strong arguing one way or another, because I do think that, you know, ultimately these people are dying from the Nebuchadnezzar
yeah.
Siege,
yeah.
right?
I was wondering, though, like the shape of the throne. So there's something that's like a throne
mm-hmm.
there. And then that's why I was kind of going, leaning towards purification, because everything under that throne has to be purified,
mm-hmm.
possibly. That's kind of where I was going, thinking about, but
mm-hmm.
I could be totally wrong on that.
Yeah, I think one of the things to think about, too, here is that the picture isn't so much of God arriving on his chariot. It's like he's been there over the ark, and now this is taking him away. So again, it's hard to, there's aspects of this that are like the parables, right? Because when God is between the cherubim over the mercy seat, his glory residing there, nobody sees wheels within wheels and these four special cherubs
mm-hmm.
or anything like that. But in this revelation that Ezekiel's seeing of his portable throne when he's about to leave, they're there. And the part that's hard is, you know, nobody in that temple probably saw any of this, right? But also, I have no doubt that these wheels and these cherubs and the portable throne are real,
mm-hmm. yeah.
right? They might not be seen in the physical realm, but when you see the rest of Revelation and
right.
other parts of Scripture, it's pretty clear that, you know, that that is a reality in the spiritual realm.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you got a mix of the material realm, the spiritual realm, and when he goes in and marks people and judges the ones. You know, he says, go in to kill the ones that don't sigh and cry. How that works out in the real material
right.
part of things is probably
right.
the
yeah.
siege and the disease.
That's
and Nebuchadnezzar,
exactly, yeah.
yeah. And God is just showing Ezekiel that the real reason, the real cause behind, you know, these people dying is God's will.
Yeah. And the
and
ones
his,
who die during that siege are the ones who are marked and the ones who...
Right.
who don't die are the ones that
sigh and cry.
Yeah, the
yeah.
ones who were marked,
marked.
And the ones
yeah.
who were not marked are the ones who died
right.
during the siege. And who knows what goes on around us right
mm-hmm.
now? You know,
yeah.
the when we die or when we don't die, and how God is orchestrating the whole thing. And with angels or whatever,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that affects an area too. So that could be it, because it's kind of. This is a very gruesome thing, thinking this right here. But then again, back when, I don't know.
mm-hmm.
I just
it
wouldn't be, but it not that it didn't happen, but it is kind of far removed from our reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, well, if you know, when you look at the 144,000 in Revelation 7 and 14 that
yeah.
are marked
yeah.
for protection, and if we were, and this is where people argue about the book of Revelation, because it says it's given in sign, symbol, and so how far do you take the symbol? That's the big, you know, difference of opinion, but What I would say is it's similar to this. You have people who are marked in a supernatural way. People can't see that mark physically.
Mm-hmm.
God is saying, he gives instructions, you know, not to destroy the ones with the mark. So the angels and whoever are bringing the judgments can discern.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think when it plays out in history, people will just see these people don't get killed. But it's not going to be obvious why
yeah.
or how.
Right? So this tells us.
This
God
tells
actually
us.
Says it.
Yeah. And in a lot of ways, I mean, that's really what the Bible is, isn't it? It's basically saying, you know, it's like Flatland. You guys live in two dimensions, but really there's three dimensions. And God's saying, here's what the third dimension is that you can't discern.
Mm-hmm.
You're living in Flatland and everything looks flat to you, but here's really what's going on, and this third dimension is the spiritual dimension that we can't see, we can't detect. You know, so, you know, we got x-rays, we got infrared, we got, you know, radiation. We can detect all these things, but we can't detect the spiritual realm. And so the Bible comes along and says, you know, here's the physical world, and then here's the spiritual backdrop behind it, what's going on and what the motivations are. And so that's how it can tell us things about, you know, angels and demons and this whole part of the world that we don't see. So yeah, it's I think it's primarily trying to tell us God's revealing the motivations behind what's actually happening and how to understand it from a spiritual perspective. That the people that are getting killed by Nebuchadnezzar and the famine and stuff, he's just a tool. In a sense, you could look at Babylon and his army as battle axes.
Yeah, and knowing that God brought him there to purpose to do this task. So. Mm-hmm.
And then judges Babylon for beating up on Israel.
Yeah, for enjoying it too much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go figure.
Yeah.
It's the mystery.
Mm-hmm. So, should we go further?
Yeah.
So, we want to do like 3 through 15.
Whoa.
Wow.
Now the cherubim were standing on the right side of the temple when the man entered, and the cloud filled the inner court. Then the glory of the Lord went up from the cherub to the threshold of the temple, and the temple was filled with the cloud, and the court was filled with the brightness of the glory of the Lord. Moreover, the sound of the wings of the cherubim was heard as far as the outer court, like the voice of God Almighty when he speaks. And it came about when he commanded the man clothed in linen, saying, "Take fire from between the whirling wheels, from between the cherubim," he entered and stood beside a wheel. Then the cherub stretched out his hand from between the cherubim to the fire which was between the cherubim, took some, and put it into the hands of the one clothed in linen, who took it and went out. And the cherubim appeared to have the form of a man's hand under their wings. Then I looked, and behold, 4 wheels beside the cherubim, 1 wheel beside each cherub. And the appearance of the wheels was like the gleam of a Tarshish stone. And as for their appearance, all 4 of them had the same likeness as if one wheel, as if one wheel were within another wheel. When they moved, they went in any of their 4 directions without turning as they went. But they followed in the direction which they faced, without turning as they went. And their whole body, their backs, their hands, their wings, and the wheels were full of eyes all around, the wheels belonging to all 4 of them. The wheels were called in my hearing the whirling wheels, and each one had 4 faces. The first face was the face of a cherub, the second face was the face of a man, the third face of the face of a lion, and the fourth the face of an eagle. Then the cherubim rose up. They are the, they are the living beings that I saw by the river Chebar.
Okay. So it sounds real similar to chapter 1, huh? So
he didn't say that there was the image of a man above.
Yeah. I would assume there still is, but it doesn't say.
Well, I thought it said that God got off the chariot and went into the temple.
Yeah.
So maybe the,
I don't know.
Yeah, because it says that that doesn't say that he goes up out of the temple and he appears over by the someplace out by the south gate or east gate, I mean, and then he goes.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like different steps in the whole thing.
Yeah, and I think you can make a pretty good case he's still on the throne and it's on the chariot. Yeah. Yeah. Because it's not about the chariot departing, it's about God's glory departing the temple. So it's a very mysterious scene like we talked about when we were in chapter one. But I think people have said it's a rocket ship and all kinds of weird things. But I think it's pretty safe to say it's a throne, it's a portable throne, chariot throne. And the reason that people talk about it being a chariot throne is there are passages that talk about it with that terminology. So that's part of the kind of picture of...
With swing low, sweet chariot.
Well, yeah.
Michael. I think that's a different chariot.
It must be different.
Mm-hmm. No, that was like Elijah's chariot, right?
Right, yeah. The chariot of Israel, horsemen.
Yeah.
If we were living in that time, we'd probably understand more about what he's looking at, because we would know the colloquialisms of what's going on. He would say, this looks like this, and everybody kind of knows what he's looking at, but we don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to the degree that it's patterned after things that are more familiar to them, like chariots and so on, I think that would be true. And then there's the aspect where it's like a heavenly scene that nobody has seen, mm-hmm. And so then that's hard. It seems like he's struggling sometimes, like when he talks about a wheel within a wheel, like we talked about different ideas about that, and that's just a hard one to understand. But clearly there's these four wheels, mm-hmm. and there's a cherubim by each wheel that's connected with it.
I know it could, I'm not saying that's it, but a wheel within a wheel. You ever seen these wheels that when you stop, they're still spinning inside?
Mm-hmm.
that's a kind of wheel within the wheel-like mm-hmm. type situation. I was going to...
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what those segues and those things are...
Well, you've seen them on cars.
Designed.
Because one time I stopped, I was coming to a four-way, and a guy pulled up and had those wheels, and they were still spinning. Mm-hmm. I slammed on my brakes because I thought he was still
mm-hmm.
moving.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I got the impression, I think Jerry was kind of talking about this too when we first looked at this, is that the angels have these four faces that all four look four different directions at once, and they're not mm-hmm. turning their heads. They're going mm-hmm. in the direction of one of the faces. And the wheel within the wheel, some people think, is talking about, there's a rim this way and a rim that way, and they intersect each other. In other words, there's wheels that run through each other,
yeah,
but
like
they function
as physical impossibility.
Yeah, physical impossibility.
Well, not really.
And
because if you have a circle here and a circle here, it could be like that. Part of this circle could be inside of that circle.
So, yeah.
Yeah, but
so,
we're talking
and
about...
And that would go in two... It could go in either direction.
Yeah, but if it's on...
Moving. So
yeah.
You couldn't...
Yeah. So the idea is, if it's like a regular wheel, they both have the same diameter or
mm-hmm.
radius.
Basically, it would be a ball.
Yeah, it'd be like a ball, and it doesn't turn. So
mm-hmm.
it goes, mm-hmm. it can go, depending mm-hmm. on which wheel is spinning at the time through the other. I'm just saying that's what some people have said. I don't know. Yeah.
So then, if God didn't get off the chair and didn't go in the temple, so they're already in the this thing is already in the temple.
Mm-hmm.
So it says when it's standing on the right side of the temple.
Which verse are we at now?
Back in 3. So now the cherubim were standing on the right side of the temple when mm-hmm. the men entered, and the cloud filled the inner court.
Yeah, the man who went in is
the man in
linen. Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it says the glory of the Lord went up from the cherub. So that's not the cherub setter that with these wheels and stuff. That's the cherub on the ark.
But when it says went up from the cherub, I think it's talking about the whole thing moving, because it talks about the sound of the wings of the cherubim in verse 5, so like they're taking flight now.
Okay.
I don't see it as him separately leaving.
No. I mean, like he's God leaving, you know, leaving the temple,
right.
Because he starts at the cherub over the ark where he normally sits,
uh-huh.
And then it says he goes to the, or the inner court was filled,
right,
and then it says, the temple, the next thing it says is the temple was filled, or
mm-hmm.
goes to the threshold of the temple, and the temple was filled, so that's the sanctuary-ish
mm-hmm.
area, and then,
the noise of it,
the threshold, yeah, the threshold, and then like, I don't know, later on,
mm-hmm.
it departs from the threshold.
Mm-hmm. Right,
yeah.
Right.
I had a question. Yours says, which verse are you on? It says right side?
Yeah.
Or
right side.
Is it
three? South side.
Mine says south side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The
okay.
Cross reference is
yeah,
right.
That would be the right side.
Okay.
Because
yeah.
The temple faces east.
Right.
South.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, so the word I think is south in the Hebrew.
Right.
I mean, the word is right or south. I know, I'd have to look, but it's one or the other. One translation is interpreting it as south.
Mm-hmm.
Like left would be north.
One thing we could be out maybe a problem with is trying to locate God in one position, you know, and because
mm-hmm.
that's how we view things, but
mm-hmm.
God's everywhere. And it could be that he's in the temple, over the mercy seat and you know, the whole, you know, his glory could be there. I mean, it's like trying to.
Well, I was just confused though, because in my translation it says the glory of the Lord went up from the chair. So I thought he got off the
mm-hmm.
the chariot.
Yeah.
But that's talking about the cherub that's over the altar.
The chair.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, that's what I would. That's how I would say
yeah.
He's getting onto the chariot and leaving.
Yeah, moving
mm-hmm.
out from the
yeah.
where he normally sits.
So it is possible that the chariot, the chair, the means of motive
came
means,
to pick him
yeah,
up. Yeah,
would be out there.
Yeah.
You know, just and he gets up and goes out to that.
Right.
And he, you know, his essence
yeah.
or his glory
yeah.
moves from one spot to the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think when we look at the whole, you know, there's more that goes on as we get further into Ezekiel, but I think if you look at the whole pattern, it's definitely painting the picture that God's glory is leaving.
Yeah.
So, yeah, God is omnipresent, but his glory is leaving the temple.
Right.
But his glory seems to be, can be localized, is
mm-hmm.
localized.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Or he can localize it, not in
yeah.
localize.
Well, I think it's all, you know, he basically said there would be a place in among one of the tribes of Israel where he would put his name would be there. He would dwell.
Yeah.
And so, just like in the Garden of Eden, you know, where he would come in and walk with Adam. And he, so, this place where he, you know, where he's chosen to manifest his glory. So it's the, you know, it's the same, you know, basically it's describing a very similar thing to what we saw in chapter 1. I think the funniest verse to me is verse 13. As for the wheels, they were called in my hearing, wheel.
mm-hmm.
You know, and so it's almost like he's saying, these things are not like any wheel you've
yeah.
ever seen before, but they were called a wheel. And they function like a wheel. They're the thing that gives it motion with the cherubim somehow.
I think Sid had the right idea. It could be a ball, and with just the, you know, the appearance of whichever one's moving, you know, or whatever
mm-hmm.
could be inside of it, but it could be that way.
On that one, okay. I was saying I saw something when. It said wheel work on mine,
mm-hmm.
and then because I just hit it just to see what it meant, and it, you know, went to it's a whirlwind.
Mm-hmm.
So that we could whirl in all kinds of different directions. So I just thought it was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Any other comments or observations about this wild thing.
Well, this is maybe just not important, but the man in linen, he said sometimes he was going to get fire from between the things, but he doesn't actually do it himself, maybe because he can't or something, I don't know, but like the cherub has to hand it to him. I don't know if that's important or not.
Yeah, I think it could be significant because the closer you get to God, the more restricted the access is, and clearly these cherubs in the heavenly scenes, like the Zohar or whatever, they're the ones that are close to God, or even when Ezekiel gets his mouth purified, it's a cherub or a seraph, I think in that case, a burning one, that brings the coal over. And the impression you kind of get is nobody else is getting close to God as far as in that close.
Yeah, even like among spiritual beings, there's like a hierarchy. Certain beings have certain tasks and positions. Other beings are maybe not allowed to do the do other things.
Can we look at the coal thing be because it's kind of preparing where God's going to be purifying his path out?
I don't really see it that way because it's like over the whole city,
Yeah.
It doesn't talk about east of the temple or to the Mount of Olives or anything like that. But, I don't know. It's hard to say for sure. My personal view is I think it's related to judgment, but, it could be purification too, so I don't know.
On number 8, it seems to go out of its way to say looks like a hand under the wing. Kind of made me wonder why. I know it's all written together, but it goes out of its way in one particular to tell you there's a hand under a wing. It looks like a hand under a wing.
It just kind of hard for him to reach in and get that coal in the wing.
Yeah.
So maybe that he has use for those hands.
I was wondering if he was just trying to give a more complete description of these things. Because he, we said earlier that he's not even sure what he's seeing, apparently.
Right. Well, in verse 7, he says the cherub stretched out his hand. Well, so far he hasn't told us that a cherub has a hand, right?
Right. But he's just talking about a hand. Now it's a hand under a wing. So he's getting more detailed about what he's seen.
Right.
Well, it says it has the form of a man's hand.
Mm-hmm.
So it's,
Of course, he did tell us that earlier on in the book, though.
Right. But I'm saying in general, when he first describes it, it's got wings and different things. So they're really wild creatures. Right. And there's a lot of people that think that the artwork of griffins and other winged bulls that you see in Assyrian art are reminiscent of the cherubs from the Garden of Eden and the biblical record, because the ox motif is part of it, because they're bulls, winged bulls. They don't have four faces necessarily, but so there's people that think just like the flood. Memory of the flood is known in all these different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
There's stories of the global flood. So there's people that think too, some of the fantastic creatures that people have rendered in art that fly, that have animal form and so on, may be a recollection, a vague recollection to some of these animals. But the way they're described in the Bible, they're more fantastic than any of the pictures you see. In fact, as Kevin has struggled in other passages, how do you even render it in the first place, right?
Yeah.
Under the wing is something like a man's hand.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Do you ever write Ezekiel commentary yet?
No. I'm not even getting Daniel done so far. So we've looked all through Scripture before about this whole business of the four faces. There's a couple of sheets of paper on that here. I think everybody got one before about how it's related potentially to the four Gospels and stuff. So we don't need to beat that dead horse.
I'll tell you what. take one of those. I think I was gone when you
discussed
that stuff right there.
So, let's see, where are we? 16? Or do you guys have more on this?
So, this, all this whole thing is basically saying that God's preparing to leave or in the process of leaving or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, verse 18 is where it's going, basically. Before the Lord departed. That's the most important phrase in the whole chapter, maybe close to in the whole book.
Okay, so this answers that one question about his position and the, and the cherubim's position, because it says he departed from the threshold of the temple, which meant he was in the temple, and then
he
took that position
on the
of
throne.
The man above, above the throne that we talked about.
Right.
Okay.
So maybe we should go ahead and read that section, unless anyone has anything prior to verse 16. So we want to read 16 through 22 for us?
Okay. When the cherubim went, the wheels went beside them. And when the cherubim lifted their wings to mount up from the earth, the same wheels also did not turn from beside them. When the cherubim stood still, the wheels stood still. And when one was lifted up, the other lifted itself up, for the spirit of the living creature was in them. Then the glory of the Lord departed from the threshold of the temple and stood over the cherubim. And the cherubim lifted their wings and mounted up from the earth in my sight. When they went out, the wheels were beside them, and they stood at the door of the east gate of the Lord's house, and the glory of the Lord of Israel was above them. This is the living creature I saw under the God of Israel by the river Chebar, and I knew they were cherubim. Each one had four faces, and each one four wings, and the likeness of the hands of a man was under their wings. And the likeness of their faces was the same as the faces which I had seen by the river Chebar. Their appearance and their persons, they each went straight forward.
See, this is a very straightforward passage.
Well, it's mentioning the wheels a lot, right? So it's pretty significant, whatever it is. Because how many times it keeps just trying to describe, it keeps telling you more and more about these wheels. And
one thing that's really interesting about the wheels is the fact that they're full of eyes all the way around. And so that's what would be the significance of that, I wonder.
Well,
is it God's omniscience, or
I think it is.
Can see everything.
When you look at biblically, when you study the idea of eyes, it's talking about omniscience and intelligence. And there's other passages where it talks about, like, the seven eyes. You know, it talks about the Spirit of God and eyes that go to and fro.
But you know, it's kind of, we're talking about God's omniscience, who is, who went up and above this vehicle.
Right.
And we're talking
and
about this vehicle having having eyes all the way around it and, and certain characteristics that okay, maybe all these things are a reflection of God's character then. You think that
Well, it's possible. I think it's just describing it's a living vehicle. You know, it keeps talking about the spirit of, of the creatures is in the wheels, essentially. And I think the wheels and the creatures are divine steeds, if you will. Because it talks about God rides upon the cherubs in a whirlwind, and he flies. So, you know, this is, you know, it is a chariot and it has wheels, but it's also not like a real chariot because it's living, right? These are supernatural creatures. So, you know, when you think of in Revelation 19, Jesus rides a white horse, it says, you know, this is maybe a similar sort of idea where God is riding upon a cherub. In a sense, he's riding on these cherubs are a part of what he's riding on, but it's also in the form of some sort of a spiritual, supernatural chariot, right? So we get the idea that it's a there's places where it's connected to the idea if that he's the Lord of hosts, he's a war-making God, powerful God, so chariot fits that, right? But at the same time, there's also this idea that he flies on these cherubs and resides among them. So, you know, I think there's just a lot of different ideas that are in there, and it's tough to know. But definitely, you know, in this hierarchy of creatures, the closer the creatures get to God, the more they have attributes that seem to be like God, right? Because these living creatures have aspects, you know, the four faces and stuff that mm-hmm. are reflecting different aspects of Jesus' ministry, and you don't see that with the lower creatures, just the regular archangels, just the little archangels. They don't seem to have, you know. So it's just, it's hard to know exactly whether it's the fact that the creatures are close to God and he created them in a way where they have these manifest resemblance to, you know, super intelligence, like the eyes. But he's omniscient, which, you know, is infinite intelligence, if you want. You know, I don't know. It's hard to say. But it is definitely fascinating to try and figure it out.
Well, I've talked about the brass, there's into it, and the coals, and all of these things are different aspects, basically, of God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his judgment and purification, his righteousness, and everything. So it seems to be reflected in his means
yeah.
of transportation.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I think we run into this at other times too, and like in Revelation and a few places where he's describing something, I mean, in a language that, well, the readers at the time and then us can understand, like the animals, you know, like in Daniel where the four beasts come out, you know, and so he's describing something in terms we can understand, but it's probably not fully getting at what he's trying to describe because we just wouldn't understand it, you know. And so it seems really super bizarre, but mm-hmm. it's probably not that bizarre if you had the capacity to fathom it, you know. It probably kind of makes sense, you know.
It could be bizarre, so we can't quite...
Well, yeah,
we can't describe it.
Well,
because
right.
We don't want it to be described totally.
Well, we couldn't understand it even if it could be. That's my point. If you really described it, you probably, you know, it's like you said, describing the blueprints to a dog, you know, the CAD version of his
dog.
You just wouldn't get it.
Might be,
you know.
Explaining what you did.
So he's using terms, animals we all know, that all have attributes, you know. I don't know, it's just a...
Well, actually, I think God wrote this book using men and using anthropomorphic, is that the word? Man-like characteristics, things that we are familiar with,
yes.
So that we would understand. So that's
yeah.
exactly what you were talking about there,
yeah.
like riding on the wings of eagles or things like that,
yeah.
you know, or I would have gathered you under my wings, like, you know, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have wings, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, we get the idea of that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's also that thing you were always talking about, that, you know, God has to have a lot of mystery or he's not God anymore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So as you go up the ranks,
yes.
you know, the mystery is going to, you know.
Yes,
and that's
weirder.
Why, when you get to Revelation, it talks about these four creatures, it just calls them Zoas. You know, like we get zoology from it. They're just living things.
Yeah.
What do you mean, living things?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he doesn't even use the word creature there. He just says four living things. And it tries to describe them a little bit, but they're obviously, you know, they're as far as we know, next to God, they're like the highest
yeah.
things that he's created. And so we really don't, and we know that Satan is, as far as we know, similar, the anointed cherub that covered or whatever. So he was among this realm of angelic beings. So it's, you know, it's beyond our ability even to think about, really.
I think it kind of fits with what Jerry was saying about, you know, if these things do carry, you know, kind of portray attributes of God, the closer you get to God. I mean, you try and describe things, but like when you finally get to the, you know, the man himself, he's just so far beyond you, you can't even, like, I mean, so, like, it would make sense that the things that are closest to him would be similar, you know, or, like, just so far beyond our ability to grasp them.
Right. It kind of reminds me like a parable, where God says, you know, it's given to you to understand it, and for them, no. Yeah, it's kind of, that's where I kind of see it.
Yeah, there's no doubt that, I mean, the skeptical world that thinks the Bible is trash, they would completely mock.
Absolutely.
And I've heard, like I said, I've heard call-in programs where people are non-believers are giving their opinion about what this is, spaceship and all different things.
Patty, when you were reading through the whole Bible and you were the skeptic with your friend, do you remember anything about what you thought about this stuff?
Mm-mm, not this part, no. I don't even remember reading this part. I'm sure it is, but I probably just thought it was, well,
so far out that you were in
a drug trip or something.
I remember the first time I read through the Bible, I kind of just, I don't even remember this book, because, like, I read it, I know I read it, but, like, it was just, went so far over my head, I was like, no, retained nothing.
Let's see, so the glory of the Lord departs. So when else did the glory of the Lord depart? Going backwards.
The garden.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah, kind of. He kicked man out.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, and then he guarded the garden from man coming back in.
What was the temple with Isaiah?
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't there something with that too?
Okay, so well, there was a tabernacle, right, before this. You remember a time when God's glory departed Israel?
Well, it had to be when they took the Ark of the Covenant away from Israel. Yeah, the Philistines took it.
Right.
I mean, God wouldn't stay there with the Philistines.
So the capture of the Ark at Shiloh by the Philistines. Remember the Eli is the priest and his sons are up to no good, and Israel goes to battle against the Philistines and they're not doing so well, so they decide, well, let's take the Ark out to the battlefront. And the Ark, the unthinkable happens, the Ark gets captured by the Philistines. And then his two sons are killed during the battle, and then the guy runs back to Eli to tell, back to Israel to tell him, remember, that this has happened. And Eli's daughter-in-law is having a baby. Remember what she names the baby when she hears about it?
Ichabod.
And that's basically two words. Kabod means glory. In fact, the word here for glory is kabod. And it means weight or reputation or glory, and it is a shortened form of not. So Ichabod is the glory. There's no glory anymore. It's departed. So she names the child, saying the glory of God has departed. And and in fact, in Psalm 78, it basically says the same thing. In Psalm 78, it says that God forsook the tabernacle of Shiloh, the tent he had placed among men, and delivered his strength into captivity and his glory into the enemy's hand. So he allowed the ark with his, you know, associated glory to go into enemy's hands. And you remember they had all the tumors. And then even when the ark came back, they had these cows that had newborn calves, and they said, put these cows that had newborn calves in a cart and put the ark on it, and if they leave their calves and go back to Israel, then it's God's doing. And that's exactly what happened. These calves went back. And then when it got back to where it was going, a bunch of people in that town peeked into the ark, and they died from it.
There was the one guy that the ark started to fall over, and he pushed it back up and got
right.
killed him.
Yeah, that was a little bit later when they were moving. That was like 20 years later. They went to move it to Jerusalem, and they carried it. Well, they had
they put it on
ox cart.
Yeah,
supposed to be carried.
Yeah. And, yeah, and they're supposed to carry it specifically.
Right. So this is very similar to Shiloh in the sense that when God leaves the house, then it can fall. You know. So in this case. Mm-hmm. You know, it's unthinkable that the temple would be destroyed, right? Because the glory of God is there. But, in fact, Nebuchadnezzar is going to destroy the temple. And so in Shiloh, it was a little bit different, but the same idea. It was unthinkable that if they went to war with the ark among them, that God would allow the ark to be captured by Gentile unclean hands, right? But he did, in fact, allow that. And that's essentially how he departed Israel right then during that time. So that would be the case where he departed and his glory departed. So it's very similar to this. And then if you go forward from this, where would be a situation where the glory of God departs and then there's destruction of the temple?
When Jesus left.
Yeah. So when Jesus leaves in Matthew 23, right, he says to them, your house is left desolate. And the house is talking about the temple. And so there's this issue that when, what we'll see here is that the glory of the Lord is going to the east gate, then it's going to, we'll see in the next chapter, it's going to go to the Mount of Olives. And that's the same route that Jesus retraces when he leaves the final time he leaves the temple. He predicts, you won't see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, your house has left you desolate. And then he goes up on the Mount of Olives, and that's where he gets questioned about, well, what about this temple? And he predicts its destruction, which happens in 70 AD. So I think it's pretty clear that that here the glory departs and goes out the east gate and out to the Mount of Olives. And then the next time the glory shows up, it's in incarnate,
right?
It's Jesus comes back to the, and that's the sense in which it. There's a passage that talks about the Zerubbabel's temple, the temple Nehemiah and those guys, Ezra and Nehemiah. You know, they come back and they build this kind of small temple, and it does get elaborated by Herod. But when they build it, it's kind of a bit of a joke compared to. I mean, it's not as glorious as Solomon's temple, and people weep about it.
Yeah, the older people who saw the original temple
right.
wept about it because it wasn't that as...
And the prophet makes a statement, the glory of this temple will surpass the previous temple. And there's different ideas about that, but I'm one of those who thinks that that's basically because God incarnate is going to walk into this temple.
Now, so what you're saying is between this time and Jesus' return, was there in the first place an Ark of the Covenant in Zerubbabel's, in that temple, and in Herod's?
Yeah, so
and
I'm not
was
sure.
Was the glory of God there?
Yeah, so that
it didn't sound like it.
No, there's no record that the glory of God was there, and even the rabbinic writings indicate, you know, outside the Bible, that the glory of God wasn't there. There's disagreements about what happened to the ark. That's the big mystery, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, when you look at how Nebuchadnezzar comes and takes the treasure. It goes in sections at a time, and it doesn't specifically mention the ark, of course. And then you have when Cyrus and subsequent kings let them come back, they're given the temple treasures, but it doesn't ever mention the ark. And you would think if the ark was included, it would definitely be mentioned. Mm-hmm. So it's generally acknowledged that the Bible definitely doesn't indicate that there was an ark in the temple, in the second temple, and a lot of the writings of the Jews are silent on that issue as well. So that's left people wondering all sorts of things about, you know, did they hide the ark under the Temple Mount before Nebuchadnezzar finally sacked the temple? And some people say, well, who cares? What does it matter? Because God talks about, there's a point where he talks about the ark won't even come into remembrance in the future because it's just not relevant. But then again, you see in Revelation, the ark appears in the heavenly setting.
Well, it's already there. Mm-hmm. Because wasn't the ark that was here
a model?
A shadow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I guess there's a big mystery about what became of the ark, and there's all kinds of fanciful stories surrounding it.
So now the chief priest, the head priest, mm-hmm. whatever he's called, that went in once a year into the Holy of Holies. The Holy of Holies was still there because the curtain was ripped from top to bottom.
Right.
Now, if there was no ark in there, what did he do in there?
Well, that's a good question. And so that's what I'm saying is we just really don't know.
Yeah.
And the way it was supposed to be done, the poles from the ark that were supposed to be left in it were supposed to extend out past the curtain in a sense so that you could see you could see the poles, you know, where you could see that the poles were there and inferring that the ark was there. But so I don't, you know, I've read a number of books by different people who are experts on the temple, and really there's a big empty spot there about what about the ark, where is the ark. And then of course anytime you have an object like that and a mystery, it really gets out of proportion in a hurry. And so, you know, there are some people who say, well, the Jews have the ark somewhere and they're, you know, if they get the temple built again, they're going to trot it out again and set it up. And other people say, no, it was destroyed and we don't know where it is. And I don't know where the ark is.
Mm-hmm. Well, you almost have to wonder about if it wasn't in those last one or two temples.
Herod's, yeah.
Why would it be in this temple? Because it's going to be defiled too, so I have to go and wonder. Well, I don't know, maybe it's not even. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is too, there's this whole issue again of what kind of a temple. And it's a little bit of a rabbit, but in Revelation 11, where it talks about a temple there. That temple is not the millennial temple, but and the millennial temple can't be built, as I understand it, without geographical changes taking place on the Temple Mount because its size won't fit. And so it talks about the mountain of the Lord's house will be lifted up. I mean, it's not just saying that it's going to be exalted. It actually seems to be describing mm-hmm. geographical changes that take place at the second coming of Christ or near to it. So that also argues that the one in Revelation 11 isn't built according to the millennial temple plan. But then it seems like, I'm trying to remember now, I read some about this, about there's some Jews that are planning, you know, to build the temple, and I don't think that they're basing it on the millennial temple plan.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if they're not, then it would seem if they're going back to previous ideas about what, like Zerubbabel's temple or whatever, then they're going to be thinking about, you know, wanting to have an ark if they don't have an ark. The millennial temple doesn't appear to have an ark, so, you know, if they were doing that one, they would be looking for that. So there's just a lot of questions about it, and it's one of those things that God, you know, knows exactly what's going to happen when, and there's a lot of mystery associated with it. And you know, there are a lot of Christians who get real nervous even talking about the ark, because when you talk about the ark and God's glory and stuff to them, it's just like you're going backwards, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, Jesus came to destroy the ark, you know, and set up a new temple, and so now you're, you know, you're going back into the law, and all this is kind of their view about it. So, but I think we'll see as we get further into the book of Ezekiel that God's glory does come back. So you have this glory departs, it's going to go out the east, and it's going to go to the Mount of Olives and then leave, and then Jesus comes to this temple, God in the flesh, and then he leaves and pronounces its destruction, kind of like this here, the same, he's reenacting the same departure. And then there's a time in the future where the glory of the Lord, we'll see it later in Ezekiel, where the glory of the Lord comes back through the east gate, and then once it comes in, it's sealed. It's no longer open. And I think the symbolism there is that God will never depart.
Do you remember when Mike and you and I were making this for you?
Uh-huh.
And we were watching that TV program, and
right.
They were looking for the ark, and it was in Ethiopia, and they were raiding through the city. And do you remember that, Mike?
No.
Yeah, it was a TV show.
It was a TV show that we were watching,
it was pretty funny because it was in Ethiopia, and these people were running down the street with the thing on their shoulders.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be the ark.
Supposedly there are Jews in Ethiopia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, they're running around with the ark. It didn't look like the biblical ark. They weren't carrying it the right way.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
There's all these different things about it.
Yeah, lots of problems with that time when they touched it.
Yeah. So it just didn't.
So they were active.
It didn't look real serious. And if they really had the ark, I don't think they'd just pull it out and run down the street with it.
Yeah.
They would have a simile or something.
It's not in the warehouse in New York somewhere.
It probably is. It's probably in some warehouse somewhere.
Did you ever see Raiders of the Lost Ark?
Yeah.
That would be a hot thing if you were there, that people would want it. I don't care, believer or Jewish or non-Jewish would want that thing. There'd be such a mass war over that. It would be unbelievable.
Indiana Jones.
Yeah. Has anybody ever heard the name Ron Wyatt? Ron Wyatt.
You talked about him here, didn't you?
Not here, no. But he's dead now. But while he was alive, he was a lot of trouble. He's a Christian who made wild claims, archaeological claims. Okay, he discovered the real Mount Sinai. He discovered the Ark of the Covenant. He discovered, I don't know, four or five other things. And so he had this whole presentation he gave where he discovered the Ark of the Covenant, essentially an underground chamber underneath the place where Jesus was crucified. And so the blood of Jesus ran down off the cross into this crack and ended up falling on the mercy seat in this cavern underneath.
Right.
I mean, it's a pretty cool idea, right? But
makes for good script.
Yeah. But you know, it's like the other ark, Noah's Ark, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are bona fide, not very many, but there are some bona fide, really solid Christians who are involved in searching for the ark. Randall Price would be one of them, and they're using computer stuff and satellite imagery and a lot of different stuff, and these are careful people who don't exaggerate. And then for every little group like that, there's like 50 that are ready to they're just seat of the pants. And this Ron Wyatt was like that. I mean, he meant, I'm sure he meant well. I mean, he believed he discovered these things, but there'd be all these news releases and things, and people get all excited, and it was all just a big hoax. And that's happened a lot with evidence for Noah's Ark as well, over and over.
The Shroud of Turin,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of mystery about that, too. So, you know, it's one of those things you have to be skeptical until you see the whites of their eyes or something.
One other thing, we know there's supposed to be a new temple built during the tribulation because of the Antichrist and everything comes up. Is there any thing written about the destruction of that temple?
No, not that I know of, other than it says, it talks about on the wing of abomination, destruction will be poured out on the abominator. It, there's implications there that when, potentially, that when God destroys Antichrist, that the idol that's in the temple and the temple might end up being destroyed as well. Yeah. And whether that's when his feet touch down on the Mount of Olives, you know.
Because we're doing a lot of reading into stuff to even get to the temple being there
right.
in the first place.
Right.
It has to be there for certain things to happen. But anyway, I was just wondering.
Yeah. I don't know. It does, I think there's disagreement among the Jews too as to whether or not they should even be building a temple, because there's some Jews that think that Messiah will build a temple when the real one shows up, what they think is the real one, right? And we go, yeah, Messiah came and he did build the New Testament temple, and we're it, right? So some Jews are opposed to the Temple Institute, and some of these other Jews that are trying to prepare to build a temple, because they're like, no, we shouldn't be doing any of that. Messiah is going to do that when he gets back, when he comes.
They have all the instruments done, even a red heifer now, which I guess that's...
They're looking for priests, the last I've heard.
Yeah, I've heard that they basically got that all.
They're training them, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's amazing.
Yeah. So it is kind of funny, not funny, but it's strange in a way, because, there's this, like I say, there are a large number of Christians who don't expect there to ever be any temple ever again, and view it akin to blasphemy for anyone to build a temple, or even to be thinking about it. And yet, of course, in this book, we're going to see that it does talk about a future temple. And then at the same time, you've got, here we are 2,000 years from Jesus, and over in Israel, there's all these people doing this weird stuff about temples. And it's kind of like, what a coincidence, right? I mean, for those of us who are looking at the scripture and where it says, we don't believe that Antichrist has come already, and it says he's going to take his feet, representing himself as God in the temple of God. And if we believe that's future, well, there has to be, it has to be a temple. So I guess what I'm saying is that people who deny that, I guess they just, my understanding is they just pass the rest of the stuff off as just goofy freakishness, So those of us who are premillennial in our viewpoint are just aiding and abetting these kooks over in Israel.
Symbolic. Symbolic.
Yeah. Well, what they do with that passage is they say that when he takes his seat in the holy place, that's in the heart of the believer.
Yes.
Yeah. In the temple.
Yeah.
Right. Anyway. So Ichabod, this whole business about, leaving. And even Jeremiah says in Lamentations, of course, Jeremiah wrote Jeremiah and Lamentations. It says in Lamentations 2:7, actually starting in 2:6.
Jeremiah, you say?
Or Lamentations, sorry. Lamentations 2:6. So it's talking about this whole business of him spurning Israel in his place. And so in verse 6 it says, he has done violence to his tabernacle as if it were a garden. He has destroyed his place of assembly. The Lord has caused the appointed feasts and Sabbaths to be forgotten in Zion. And then it says, in his burning indignation, he has spurned the king and the priest. So there's the throne of David and the Levitical priesthood. Aaronic priesthood. And then notice it says in 7, the Lord has spurned his altar, he has abandoned his sanctuary. He has given up the walls of her palaces into the hand of the enemy. So Jeremiah is prophesying. He's a contemporary of Ezekiel, and he's got the same historic topic in view, which is the fall of Israel to Babylon. And here he is. He's basically giving the same picture that God is giving the walls of his palaces into the hands of the enemy, and he's abandoning his sanctuary.
Tony, can I ask a really basic question just to make sure I have this straight? This temple we're talking about is Solomon's temple. It's destroyed by Babylon, and then Zerubbabel's temple, when they return, Jews build that temple, which is the same temple that moves into Jesus' day, right? That's the second temple.
Right.
And then that one's destroyed by the Romans.
Right.
And then there's the temple that's at the end of this book is the millennial temple that a lot of people don't think is real.
That's right.
And then there's another temple in the book
of Revelation.
So this one is what, destroyed the millennial temple?
Which temple?
The one at the end of the book.
The one at the end of the book isn't destroyed. No, so what happens is you got the second temple, right? The
Zerubbabel's, yeah.
And Herod
enlarges
on that.
Yeah.
And so that's the one Jesus comes into. It's called Herod's temple, the second temple. And then that one is destroyed in 70. Okay.
Right.
And then way out at the end of the book of Ezekiel, we've got the millennial temple. But in between there, in the book of Revelation, in chapter 11, it talks about a temple.
Right.
And that's not the millennial temple.
Okay.
And as best as we can tell, that's the temple that the Antichrist says
he is. Because the millennial rose
after that. Somehow between now and the millennial temple, if we're right in our understanding of Revelation and eschatology and stuff, then there will be another temple built that is the one that's the tribulation temple, often called. And it does, you know, most people believe that that is connected with, potentially with this covenant. In Daniel, it talks about the Antichrist making a covenant with many in Israel for a week, and then he intervenes in sacrifice and offering. And so the implication is that that covenant had something to do with sacrifice and offering, and that would require a temple. So there are many people today who notice that, what do a bunch of Jews want to do? They want to build a temple, and how is it that they could build a temple? It's impossible. But maybe someone's going to come along someday with a solution.
Mm.
And this person is going to, this Jerusalem and this temple and this whole dog snarly mess that's there is somehow going to be solved by some statesman, and in the process Israel will get the Orthodox portions of Israel will get a temple, and that would be potentially, I mean, if we're Christians, we're hanging around and they're starting to build a temple there,
we may have missed the rapture.
You know, so there's a sense. Yeah, we need to get nervous. No, but there's a sense in which we're sitting here with Israel since 1948, okay? And we're like, oh yeah, that's pretty significant, whatever. There's a bunch of believers that are dead now that if they lived to 1948 and saw Israel declare itself a nation in 48, they would have gone absolutely berserk because there was no Israel. They didn't even have a map of Israel in their Bibles. The idea that there would have been a nation in 1948 was something that they had gone out on a limb and predicted because of Scripture, and they were scoffed at.
Yeah.
And so for it to be reestablished at that time, to them would have been mind-boggling, but also an amazing. So what I'm saying is, whatever generation, us or later, maybe David's, maybe the next, whatever, when they start laying a foundation for a temple, yikes.
I was actually just going to say that when they actually do start building a temple, there's going to be people just jumping up and down, being, look at this, look at, didn't we say so? You know, and at the same time they're going to be like, okay, now brace yourself.
Right. So the thing that I think Jerry pointed this out too, in some things he said, is like there's. People are constantly trying to fit events into the Bible, but there are some events like the fact that there is a nation Israel that shows up on the stage late in history, that, you know, if they were to build a temple against all odds, right, those are not just speculative things that you try to shoehorn into Scripture, right? They're, because they're things that Scripture talks about.
Yeah.
And so when Jesus says, you know, when the abomination of desolation is standing in the holy place, you've only got two options. He's either saying it's going to happen before 70 AD, because the holy place goes away in 70 AD, or it's got to happen, there's got to be another temple.
Yeah.
And so there's the divide right there. Is a lot of Christians say, well, it had to happen before 70 AD because there, you know, it had to happen when there was a temple there, because there's not ever going to be another temple. And then there's the other Christians that say, well, wait a minute.
Well, there's only one temple, which tells you that the tribulation temple definitely has to be done away with somehow before the millennial temple. Because there is only one temple.
Right.
Do we know what happens with the millennial temple? Because it doesn't seem to be in the new heavens and the earth.
No, right. So what happens is the new heavens and the new earth at the end of the millennium.
Okay, that gets rid of that.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then the new Jerusalem is the temple. Mm-hmm. The Lamb and God are the temple. There is no temple. So.
Mm-hmm. Just wanted to make sure I had that clear.
Definitely a push to find a place to put that temple.
Yeah. And so
there's a couple of theories on that.
Yeah. Right. So the thing that's just frustrating as a Christian, and you run up against it all the time, is that you have all this focus on Jerusalem, you have all this focus on the Jews, you have all this focus on this Temple Mount, right? And a bunch of Christians don't think any of that is significant anymore. It's all just a distraction. Yeah. And that's the part that's it's a spiritual thing.
Because
it's just like, how could we be 2,000 years from Jesus and this stuff's going on and you think it has no relation to the Bible?
Yeah, it's like, it's one thing to like read about prophecy. It's another thing to see it actually happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like what do they do with, you know, Israel was, you know, born?
Yeah.
What are those people doing?
They don't think it has biblical significance.